Om Shanti. Good evening, dear brothers and sisters. Hope you have good rest and prepared for a big session. I'm glad and honored to introduce Sister Jayanti. Sister Jayanti is a soul, but such a bright one. She is playing the role of a spiritual leader and a senior Raja Yoga meditation teacher. She has been practicing this for more than 55 years. And currently, she is having the position of additional administrative head of the Brahma Kumaris. She also has a position in the United Nations representing the non-governmental organization that's called NGO. And she has such a high level representation there, which is called a general consultative status, which is the highest level any NGO representative can achieve. Sister Jayanti is very well known for her serene presence, her deep wisdom, and her very powerful commentary meditation. I have the great opportunity of knowing her since the beginning of joining Raja Yoga Meditation 13, 14 years back. And I was always admire her being a practical example of what does Raja Yoga life is. So she's like a practical living form of that. And she was always a wonderful teacher in a way that no matter how big or complicated the topic she take, she can simply summarize it in points and sub-points, and when you listen to her, you can easily grasp whatever she is explaining. So it goes not only to your mind, but directly to your heart. So touching the heart and the mind and giving the maximum experience. And from the very beginning, I like that slogan that says, grind your own ingredient. And she was the one who explained that to me. And it means no matter how much you like a person, no matter how much you are impressed with their, specialities or their qualities, you have to work on yourself because you are not going to be a copy of anyone. So no matter how great the person is, work on yourself to achieve what you can achieve for yourself. Sister Jayanti is going to talk about the cycle of life, which is really deep aspect of Raja Yoga teaching. And I'm sure you will find it very interesting. I'm expecting a lot of question marks in the air and questions on the papers. So after that session, we will have 30 minutes of break. Please be sure to hand over your question to me in writing. I would appreciate that your questions be brief, sensible. Think before you write your questions so you know exactly what you want to know. So in this way, we will not miss the opportunity of going over all the questions. Okay, we really value your questions. So if it is clearly written in a clear, brief way, we will be able to handle them all. Okay, we will have a question and answer after the break for 40 minutes. Thank you very much. Over to you, Sister Jayanti. Thank you.
Thank you, Salva. It's lovely to meet you all. And some of you I know, and some of you I'll be meeting for the first time. Early days in Raja Yoga, I used to think, but why do we need to know the cycle? It's so complicated. If we just were to know about soul and God, isn't that enough? And yet, as I continued to practice meditation, within a very short space of time, I could understand that knowing the cycle meant to know my own journey. Knowing the cycle meant that I could understand what was happening in the world at that time. And this was at the end of the 60s. And the world wasn't in such a challenging situation as it is today. So I've now understood very deeply that in fact it's the concept of the cycle that actually helps me become a yogi. And as I explain it, you'll understand more. And the first aspect of the cycle that makes a lot of sense is that when you look at nature, do you see anything which is a straight line? You're seeing a tiny glimpse of nature here inside. And there's beauty, there's a wonderful cohesion and harmony, but there's no straight line, right? Look at the cycle of day and night. Again, it's a circle. When it's dark, a child may think that the sun is never going to shine, but the mother will tell the child, it's okay, the day will come. And of course, the day does come. Or when we look at the cycle of seasons, and again you think, in winter, what does the future hold? I was 8 years old when my family migrated from India to London. And when we arrived in London, it was December, and December 57, and it was a very harsh winter that year, and there was a lot of snow, and the trees had no leaves. And I was shocked when I saw that, this tree and no leaves. And I got used to seeing this, and I thought, well, that's what England is like. They don't have leaves on their trees. And I thought it would be like that forever. And I didn't ask anyone, and nobody said anything. And then when spring came, it was a beautiful joy to see the little buds come out and the little greenery come out and then the blossoms come out. And I began to understand that there's a season that I hadn't known about in India in the same way. I'd known about spring and summer and monsoons, but I hadn't known really about winter. And now I'd seen winter, but after that I was seeing the spring and summer. And so everything goes in a circle. And there's a moment of time when you don't realize it, but then when you do realize it, it makes a lot of sense. And so the story of humanity is again the same. And the starting point is actually right now. This is the moment when we are creating the period, the most important period, the period of transition. But it's the period in which we understand the whole cycle. In any other part of the cycle, whichever part of the cycle you may be in, you don't know the whole story. But at this point, you know the whole cycle. You know, we love going up to the top of the tower. We love going up to the top of the hill or whatever it may be. Why? So that we can have a bird's eye view of everything that's around. In the same way, if I stand at the top and I look at the whole cycle, I'm able to see the whole story very clearly. And so to stand at the top is very important. Otherwise you only get a partial glimpse of something here, something here, something here. And so how can I understand more? This is that period, the top of the cycle, when we can see what's been happening in the past, but we can also see what's going to happen in the future. One man, Brahma Baba, had a vision of both what was going to happen in the immediate future, but also in the distant future. And today I would say, yes, we can see what's going to happen in the immediate future, but also the future beyond that is not too distant. It's very, very close. And so now, at this moment, I know three things which I didn't know through the whole cycle. I know myself, I know God, and both of these subjects, yes, today I say I know, but maybe tomorrow I'll know a little bit more, a little bit more. And each day that understanding, and more importantly, the experience will continue to go, but deeper and deeper. But yes, today I know God, I know the Supreme, but also I know the story of karma. And the story of karma, action, reaction, is also the story of the cycle. Sometimes we call the cycle the drama of life. And you can replace this word drama with the word karma. Whatever you are seeing is the drama of life today is the story of our karma. Am I right? Who thinks yes? Okay, thank you. And so definitely, when I replace the word drama with karma, it makes a lot of sense. So I look at the past, and all of that has been the karma of humanity playing out its part on the world stage. And I look at the future, and I see that the future is totally dependent on my karma today. Whatever seeds I sow today are going to be bringing the results of tomorrow. And so when Brahma Baba saw the old world in a state of collapse and a new world emerging following that, he thought very deeply, well, what does this all mean? And he also heard the words, you have to bring about this new world. And again, it took a few months of silent reflection, being in solitude, just thinking very deeply about the spiritual dimension of life. And he understood that through spiritual education, you understand how to bring about transformation today within the human spirit, so that then there can be a better world tomorrow. And so the story of the cycle is a message of hope, is a message of guarantee that yes, through the actions we perform now, there will be a better world, a better future. And so what we're doing today is sowing the seeds through our remembrance of God, through our good deeds, and also through transforming all our own negative traits in our own personality. And of course, God's remembrance enables me to do good karma, to sow good seeds for the future. But also, God's remembrance is the only mechanism that I know of that can bring about positive change and transformation in human qualities and human behavior. There can be many other methods that bring about short-term change, but long-term change happens only through this. And those are the ingredients that we now have available. So whatever it is we do is going to create the future. But apart from all of us doing the things that we need to do, there's a big majority out there who's not interested in these things. And what they're doing is just moving further and further into that materialism. The descent is very fast at the moment. Materialism, commercialism, and a state in which truly the soul gets trapped by the darkness of illusion. The ego, the anger, the greed, the attachment, the lust, these things are now really catching hold of souls in a very, very strong way. So there has to be a way in which that can also change. So this is why Brahma Baba saw the collapse of the world. And when he saw the collapse of the world, he had tears in his eyes, because he was a man of compassion. And when he saw everything just falling apart, and natural disasters happening, civil war happening, he couldn't tolerate the suffering, and he had tears. And he didn't want to see that anymore. But what he saw next was that everything became very quiet, and it was like all souls were flying home to that world of light, the dimension of the Brahma element that you've heard about in terms of the three regions, the physical, the subtle, and the supreme. So what he saw was these points of light moving towards that home and coming to a place of rest in their home, so that they had actually been liberated from their suffering and the huge amount of sorrow that they were experiencing in the physical dimension. God has always been remembered as the liberator. And on a personal level, we'll feel that, yes, God has liberated me, maybe from my anger, maybe from my ego, maybe from my attachment, and all of that is so. God's love and God's power enables me to experience liberation on a personal level. But God is also the liberator for the whole of humanity. And so the liberation of all souls, so that darkness finishes and all souls are able to experience liberation from suffering, from sorrow, from their own negativity, and they're able to go home. And then from that home, he saw what seemed to be stars. And as those stars came down into the physical dimension, they took on a human form. And when they spoke, it was like angels, it was music. When they moved, it was like a dance. They didn't need to say too much. They could just look at each other. And because there was total transparency, honesty, and love and respect, they could understand each other. They didn't need to mask anything, hide anything. They could just be totally open and transparent so that they could see what each other really wants and means. And so the vision that Brahma Baba had was of this world of truth, of love and beauty and harmony. Harmony amongst people, harmony between humans and animals, harmony between the elements of nature, but also harmony between humans and nature. And so what he was seeing was the end of the old and the beginning of the new. And we're going through that period of transition right now. We are now preparing, sowing the seeds for that better world. But apart from the external good karma that we can do, the transformation in here, in which all my old traits of personality that are negative finish, and I'm able to emerge the goodness that is there latent within the soul, and that happens through God's influence, God's remembrance. You know, when you're in company with somebody who has very strong moral values, you're definitely influenced by them. And the other way, if you're in company with somebody who's a little bit careless about values and say, you know, if you do this, so what? It's no harm. Nobody's watching. You can do this. It's okay. You get influenced by that also. But when you're under the influence of the Divine, the Supreme, then of course that influence of the Almighty Authority is the most beautiful and the most powerful of all. And it transforms the soul so that whatever negativity there is removed, and that which is good is able to emerge and be enhanced. So God's remembrance enables me to reach my own highest potential. And so that's exactly the period we're going through at this moment, the confluence, the end of the night and the beginning of the day. And when the day comes, souls come down from up above according to their state of purity and continue to experience life here on the planet, but at a time when it's in its golden age. the most perfect time in history, the most beautiful time of all. And then, gradually, very gradually, very slightly, the soul begins to lose its power. So from 100% full power, you reach the stage of 80%. Just a little bit of a loss. And so the joy, the beauty, the happiness, the love, the respect, the divinity still continue, but it's a little bit different. Not as sparkling beautiful as it was, but still beautiful nonetheless. And so we've come into the Silver Age. And then the soul loses more power, and by now it's 50%. And then there's that critical point of 50% power, there's a shift of consciousness. Instead of being aware of the shining star, the soul, gradually I become more and more conscious of the body. It's like a child. A child has no consciousness of the body, doesn't know gender, doesn't know what is aged, doesn't know anything, but just is simply happy and blissful in the parents' company. And so the golden age is that time of childhood when we enjoy, we dance, we sing, we are happy, and everything is available. We don't have to think too much. We don't have to worry at all. Everything just happens in a very natural, synchronistic way. But gradually we came to the Silver Age. And we started having to think a little bit. But still, we were in that awareness of the sparkling light. Then, halfway, and there's a major shift. And instead of being aware here, I suddenly become aware of the body. And in this consciousness of the body, Pandora's box opens. You've heard about the story of Pandora. She was told that there's this box, and she was enjoying life, and she was told, don't open this box. But of course, curiosity is a trait of human nature. And if you tell a child, don't go there, the child will definitely go there to see what's happening there, right? And so Pandora thought, well, you know, so what if I open it? I'll just have a quick peep and I'll close the box again. But the moment she opened the box, all these bugs and flies and insects all came jumping out, flying. And before she could close the box, they'd all flown out. And those bugs and flies were disease and suffering and sorrow and pain and hunger and all of these things. And then she didn't know how to get them back into the box. How is she going to catch all these flies? And so it's the story of Pandora. It's also the story of Adam and Eve. Again, a little bit similar. Eve was told, you can enjoy the Garden of Eden, every bit of it, but don't touch this tree. And once you say, don't do this, of course that's the stimulus for the other to think, well, let me find out what happens. And so they took a bite of the tree, of the apple of the tree of knowledge. And it was the knowledge of the body, not the knowledge of the spirit. And when they started to eat that apple, starting to experience life through the physical senses rather than through the inner consciousness, then lust and ego and anger and greed and attachment began. And we see the result of that. So these are images, stories, but they describe what happened at that moment of transition from the Silver Age to the Copper Age. And then at that moment, the prophets, the messengers of God come to try and bring us back to the path of truth and goodness. They have a beautiful message, and very often we forget about the message and we remember the messenger. But even though we like the message, we don't have the power to be able to follow that message. Love thy neighbor as you would love yourself. Well, I don't love myself, so how am I going to love my neighbor? How am I going to start loving myself? I'm in the habit of seeing my defects, my weaknesses, and I don't know how to change these. So how am I going to do this? I don't know. And there's a lot of analysis, there's a lot of problems that come, but I'm not learning the lesson. And nobody's there who can teach me this lesson. That you can do all of these things, you can conquer all the negativity, you can eliminate all the vices, just simply by knowing God. And we love God, we're searching for God, but there's no one who can explain to us exactly who God is. And so the descent is very, very fast. From 50%, we very quickly have lost our energy, and by the end of the cycle, we have no power. One simple example of how we can see we really have no power. I want my mind to stop thinking about what you said to me this morning. Can I stop it? I try and stop it, but my mind is out of control. It won't stop. It'll keep going back to it again and again and again. I have pain in my tooth. And my tongue keeps going to that tooth. I tell myself, stop it. But I can't even stop my tongue. My tongue keeps going back to it. I want to make a decision. And I'm not clear. I'm confused. It should be easy enough to make my decision, to understand what is right, what is wrong, what is benefit, what is damaging. But sometimes it takes days, weeks and months, and I'm still confused, even after thinking about it for a few months. So again, an indication of the loss of the capacity of the human spirit. So in all the main ways in which we want to manage ourselves and our lives, our loss of power and purity means that we're not able to do this. And so the search intensifies for God, or maybe for truth. By now many reject God, thinking maybe God's not listening, God's not answering my questions, maybe God doesn't exist, maybe it's science that will give me all the answers, maybe that's what's going to show me the truth. But science tells me one thing one day, and a little while later it'll tell me something else. That's what science is about. The path of discovery, experiment, trial and error. And so it's not going to give me the absolute truth and the total truth. And anyway, science can talk to me about what's here within the physical dimension. But where do my thoughts come from? Can I catch my thoughts? Can I control my thoughts? Thoughts are not physical. They're metaphysical. My feelings. My feelings are metaphysical. So even though we are searching in many different avenues, we are not getting answers. And so the darkness continues and the sorrow and suffering increases. And there's an analogy that's been given. The first period of truth and beauty, the golden period, the golden age. And in Hindi the word means the age of truth. Sat Yug. But in other terms, we call it the Golden Age. Then the Silver Age. Then the Copper Age. Then the Iron Age. And then the Diamond Age. Small, very short, but very valuable. More valuable than all the gold of the Golden Age. And so the diamond age is the age of transformation, and we're able to return again to the golden age. Gold, because the elements have no impact on gold. Air, water, nothing will change it. It'll still shine. Silver, now there's a little bit of tarnish that the elements bring, and I have to really rub it very clean, and then it sparkles. So it's not a permanent change, but certainly it's an influence that started to happen from outside. Copper actually changes color and becomes poisonous when it turns green. And so that period when the influence of matter is so strong that I begin to forget my own identity, there's poison in that rust. And so the soul becomes influenced by negativity. The Iron Age, iron not only changes color when it becomes rusty, it's totally poisonous. And so you touch a little bit of rusty iron, and if there's a little bit of a cut that your finger has, it'll poison you. And so it's a state in which there's a lot of sorrow and suffering, and the influence of matter is absolutely total. We get to the point where we no longer remember that we are the spirit. We just see the skin, and we judge and decide everything according to the skin. So golden, silver, copper, iron, and from iron, there has to be a mechanism to transform souls from base metal to what is precious. And so they speak about the alchemist, and in the Middle Ages they were searching for the alchemist stone that would transform base metal into precious metal. But it was a story that souls remembered, but they forgot that it was a spiritual story, and they thought that they could find a physical remedy and turn base metal into precious gold. But what God does is, when we connect with God, God touches this base metal of the stone intellect, the iron aged intellect, and transforms it into a diamond. Not just golden, but a diamond. The capacity to understand, the capacity to be able to see what's happening, the capacity to be able to know myself. All these inner powers develop through that connection with the divine. And what determines who comes to the divine is not God, it's us. If I've been through the golden age and silver age, and I've come to the copper age, and now I'm in the iron age, in the copper age, my devotion to find God, my love for God was sincere, it was true. And whatever I did on the path of devotion was also from a very sacred feeling in my heart. But those same rituals that were being done with a feeling and some awareness of truth, by the time you reach the Iron Age, that is gone. And then even the devotion has turned into commerce. Now, look at what's going on in all the traditions, in all the religions, and you'll see how true that is. Yes, there's still that love for God, but no awareness of who that being really is. And so at the end, when there's total darkness, at that time of darkness is a time when humans can't do anything anymore. In the year 2000, at the UN, they had what they called the Millennium Peace Summit. And I remember everyone's hopes were so high. The new millennium is going to be the millennium of peace. what happened? It's gone the other way. Today is worse than the 20th century in terms of the suffering and the torture and the sorrow that people are experiencing. But that's God's promise to humanity. Whenever there's sorrow and unrighteousness and irreligiousness, I will come. And I will come to establish the truth, true religion, coming back to the origin. Religion not in the sense of rituals, but religio, to reunite, to reconnect with the origin, to reconnect with God. So I come back to establish the truth, true religion, and to finish all unrighteousness. And so we are seeing these things happen today. We are seeing the preparation of the Golden Age, more and more people aware of looking at life from a holistic perspective, holistic medicine, holistic education, holistic architecture, holistic farming, everything looking at it from a new perspective, a holistic perspective. We're looking at so many people who say, well, they don't understand religion anymore, but they do know that there's someone up there. Or they do know that there's something which is beyond the physical dimension. So more people today finding the path of spirituality and meditation than ever before. And so the signs of the energy moving upwards. The rest of the world is going down. And so there's a very strong pull. Things will pull you down. But you have to keep going and connecting with God so that He's able to uplift you and carry you back to your original state of purity. No human being can do that for us. Why? Because by the time we reach the Iron Age, the state of everyone here is impure. So an impure cannot clean another impure one. It has to be the one who's eternally pure who can come and carry out this process of purification. But the thing is that God needs to speak to us in a human language. If He's speaking to us just in our heads, my interpretation of what He's saying will be one thing. Your interpretation will be another, and another, and another. And it'll be like Chinese whispers. It was very, very funny. Last week in London, we had a meeting of the people who are leading the main teams in London. And some of their main assistants. So it was a group of about 65. And we were able to sit in a circle. And the topic was communication, and the subject was, well, the game was, let's try and see what happens. One person at this part of the room was given a phrase, and that phrase was going to go round the circle and be repeated and come round to the end. And the person here was given another phrase, and that was going to do the opposite circling and come back and finish here. And when you actually do this game of Chinese whispers, it's very, very funny. Because when you land up at the end, it's two statements that are only giving 25% of what the original statement was. And everybody's intelligent, everybody's understanding, everybody's paying attention. But this is what happens with human communication. There's something that gets mixed in, and we'd say there's a misunderstanding. You didn't know, you didn't fully understand what I'm trying to say to you. So at such a time when our intellects are a little bit confused, and there's spaghetti here, not just in your bowl, but in here, God can't use human intellects to be able to give us these teachings. So what God does is to incarnate. God comes and through this human instrument of Brahma Baba shares all the teachings very, very slowly. The first teaching they were given was only of the soul. And the group that formed around Brahma Baba began to be soul conscious, began to be aware of purity in their lives, and they wanted to follow the path of purity. And of course, when, especially if it's women who say, I want to follow the path of purity, there are many obstacles that are created. When it's a man who says, I want to follow the path of purity, people put him on a pedestal and say, you're my guru. But when a woman says, I want to follow the path of purity, she can't. At least that was the condition in the 1930s, in that place which today is in Pakistan. At that time it was a combined India, but Sindh, Hyderabad, that was where all this started. And Brahma Baba, this man who had been a jeweler, changed his life completely and decided he wanted to surrender everything for the service of God. Women who were normally totally silent in front of men, even if he was their father-in-law, they wouldn't speak. They didn't have the right. They were second-class citizens. And now, as they were coming and understanding these ideas and meditating and so on, they began to change. And they realized that I have as much of a right to follow the path of purity as anyone else. They began to speak for themselves. And of course, there was a reaction from society. There were men who were coming also, and they were fine. They understood. But the other men folk didn't understand. And so it was quite a backlash. But Brahma Baba was very stable in his understanding and the visions he had seen, so his faith remained strong. You can lose your money, you can lose your health, but if you lose everyone's respect, that's what hurts very deeply. Especially when you've done nothing wrong. But still, the whole of society, the whole community is against you. And so Brahma Baba had to tolerate a lot. People saying he's a magician, he's a sorcerer, he's casting a black spell on us, he's taking us into darkness, all sorts of allegations. But Baba stayed true to the vision he had seen. And he had seen not just a transformation of the world, he had also seen a vision of God as light, a being of light. And so those visions and all the information that he became the instrument to share with us, he would listen, and it was new things for him also, because the Supreme had taken over and was now speaking. And so all this started 90 years ago. And in 90 years, the world has changed really to the point where we would now say we're at that tipping edge, the end of the Iron Age, the Dark Age. So the age of light, the age of truth, a little bit less than that, then the age of copper, and then the age of the iron. And when it's the Iron Age, truth is said to be false, false is said to be truth. There's darkness, and the intellect doesn't understand. And so, given those conditions of negativity, and then suddenly this new revolution happening, you can anticipate that there was quite a clash. But Baba was true to what he had seen and understood. But Baba decided to go to Karachi from Hyderabad. At that time it was an overnight journey. Today you can manage it in 25 minutes flight. But He came and he didn't tell anyone anything, hoping that the uproar would die down. But people somehow knew where he was. They had visions, they followed, and they arrived at his doorstep. And he understood that he had to care for all these people, because he now had a new role. He wasn't just the father of his own children, but he was the father of humanity. And so through the teachings that he'd been the instrument to give, his own third eye had opened and he could see everything with a new perspective, a new light. And as a result of that, then people started hearing, and then this is why they came to him. Once they came, he had to then make arrangements for accommodation. And so finally there were 7 houses in Karachi where they stayed. A house for the children, a house for the mothers, a house for the brothers, young brothers, married brothers, a house for the young sisters, and a house where Brahma Baba lived. So they were scattered, but they would meet together from time to time for meditation, or Brahma Baba would visit one of their homes to be able to share more. And the community gradually began to gel, and it became one family. But another very interesting thing happened through all of this. He was given the instruction that he had to make women the leaders and teachers. Now, in terms of logic, he could understand that. Why? Because he had seen the injustice that women were experiencing, and he had witnessed a world of justice. And so he knew that that has to change, and not just the injustice and equality restored, but before that could happen, women had to be given a special boost and have affirmative action. And so that was his decision, to make women teachers and leaders. But what was beyond logic was that he was also told, you have to set up a foundation and all your assets have to be given to this foundation. And these young women, some of them in their teenage years, a few who were in their 20s, so all very young, they would be 8 of them, the names were given, and they would be the ones who would then run the organization. And imagine, here's a 14-year-old girl who doesn't have a bank account, knows nothing about money, she doesn't need to, but even a 20-year-old, she's run a household, but now it's a very big family, and so things are very different. And so everything was handed over to this trust of 8 young women. And they just accepted it. They didn't quarrel about it. They didn't worry about it. And he had told his partner, whatever you feel is my righteous share, you can give it to me. And the man didn't want him to leave, because the creative energy of the business was Brahma Baba. But Brahma Baba had made up his mind. He wasn't going to stay just for money. And so he told him, no, you decide. And whatever it is you feel is my rightful share, you can give me. And that's exactly what would happen. The man gave him what he felt was the rightful share. And Brahma Baba didn't quibble about it. But now, with this awareness of this new leadership, Baba handed over everything to them. And since then, within our constitution, we have the statement that the heads of the organization must be women. And so it's a very different culture to what's out there. But this was the beginning. And guess how long they stayed as a community? They stayed in Karachi. Outside was the World War, and after that was the Partition War, but they stayed totally safe. A house where 60 young women lived. And they said to Baba, what will be our method of protection and safety? And Baba said, no human being can give you protection. No weapons can save you. But your yoga power can save you. And they believed him. And they were spending a long time. They were spending hours and hours in meditation, exploring things in the laboratory of the mind. How does the mind work? Where are my thoughts coming from? What is this thing I'm calling intellect? What is personality? Where does memory fit in within all of this? These women experimented. And through that, they were able to stabilize their mind. They were able to have hours of yoga. Sometimes they'd have a month of silence. They would have many times a week of silence. And during that period, they would have very little food. Because food takes energy. Food gives you energy, but it also takes energy to digest. And so they weren't told, don't do this, don't do this. But in a very natural way, it evolved, and that's what they were doing. And 13 years later, their families were calling them, of course, most of them had families who had now gone to India. And so the families were calling them, but the guidance that Brahma Baba was receiving, stay where you are. And then, in 1950, the guidance was, it's time to move. And it was perfect timing, because it was after that that then a military dictatorship started in Pakistan. And they wouldn't have been able to manage what they were doing under that. But the people in the country, they were very warm, very friendly, protected them through the period of the wars. Whenever there would be bullock carts coming from the villages bringing vegetables, the police would say, take them to that bungalow, take them there. These people only eat grass, they don't eat anything else. And so they'd send the bullock carts to them. So they were supported and they had good friends. And then, when the message came to move, one of them, who was actually Baba's nephew, he was able to manage all the exit program, because by then it was difficult for one person, one individual to leave. Those who left at the time of partition left, and afterwards became difficult. But this man was able to organize things for the whole community. And so 350 of them left Karachi to come by ship to Oka in Gujarat and then by train to Abu. And the climate was different. It was after the war. They arrived on the 5th of May 1950. 5550, easy to remember. So they arrived here and they'd never been on a mountain top. They'd been on sea level. So climate was changed. Food was unavailable. Altitude was different. It was a time that was testing their patience, their tolerance, their endurance. And they had one more year. So in total it was 14 years. But one more year in Abu, when again most of the time was spent in silence and introspection. They would talk, they would study together, but they would practice the things that they were studying. And this man was the one guiding them. And through that period of one year, there was a lot of physical hardship, because everything that Baba had surrendered was now 14 years gone. And then the travel to India for 350 people, hire a ship, hire a train. It's no joke. And it was challenging, but they survived that with love, with no feeling of regret. Those who wanted to leave, those who became ill, left. But those who wanted to stay, with the majority, and they stayed. And they were receiving invitations from outside to go visit their families. And in 1952, then Brahma Baba said to them, "It's time for you to go to these places and serve those people." And they left, and some went here, some went there, different places, Bombay, Delhi, Calcutta, Sri Lanka, different places. And wherever they went, people wanted them to stay because it was such a rich experience they were having from their silence, their explanation, and their questions were being answered. And so centers started to develop. And Brahma Baba had a small community. There's a hotel now in that original place where they stayed, and it's just above a graveyard. And the sannyasi, the ascetic who was at the bottom of the mountain in the cave, hated women. And he was doing black magic so that they should leave. And they didn't leave, but then they had a whole period of illness that many, many of them went through. Some of you have met Daddy Janki. Who met Daddy Janki? A handful, a few. But she was the nurse of the community. And through that period of 14 years, they only had to call an outside doctor a couple of times, because Brahma Baba told her to keep direct contact with him whenever anybody was unwell. So morning she would tell him what the health of the community and the patients was. At night she would again report back. And he would give her herbal remedies, kitchen cabinet remedies. Give this person this, give this person that. Sometimes he would tell her of the mental issues that were creating the physical health issues. And so she learnt a lot about karma through that period of time. But she learnt a lot about nursing and care and compassion and so on. So the community then reduced to about 300. But they were the strong ones who stayed. Some through illness left, some through going to their relatives, but also then deciding to stay there. So all of that was happening. And when service started, on one side, people loved them because they were getting answers, and because these women were so humble and so powerful. And on the other side, there was opposition, again from the menfolk, the sannyasis, who felt that they had created disruption. But their humility, their peace, their love established the centers. My mother came to this in 1957, and I was fortunate because it meant that as a child I went along with her. This was in Pune, which is where we were living at the time. And age 7, I met the Brahma Kumaris. And age 8, they celebrated my birthday at the center. And summer holidays were spent half a day with the Brahma Kumaris. We'd be in a garden that was nearby the center. And we'd play games and understand about soul. But it was really theory. How much do you understand when you're 8? And then a few months later, Baba was in Delhi. And so again, my good fortune that I went along with my parents to see Brahma Baba and the mother. I'm sure you haven't heard much of the mother, but that's for another time. But meeting Brahma Baba and Mama, the mother, was beautiful. Baba was like a grandfather, the embodiment of love, the tremendous spiritual authority. Mama was the embodiment of sweetness. And so it was a very deep connection that was made, even though it was just a short visit. And then we migrated to England, London. And Baba's care was such that Baba would send the daily lectures that were being given. in the ashram in Abu, and every Monday morning, without fail, there'd be this size envelope, this thick envelope, so I'd hear it fall plop on the carpet, and it was the Muralis, the teachings from Baba. So Shiv Baba, the Supreme, at that moment when it was time to bring about transformation, he was speaking through the body of Brahma. Brahma Baba didn't know these things. He didn't know about God. He'd had a vision of God as light, but hadn't fully understood. And he'd had this vision of a better world, which he didn't understand, except very, very slowly. He didn't know the detail of soul. So he didn't understand any of these things. But as that voice spoke through him, he understood. And so these were the teachings that were being shared over all those years. And when the center started, we call this the Murali, the magic flute, the music that can transform us, because it contains the elements of knowledge, how to have meditation, how to be able to apply these things in life, and also the subject of service. All four subjects were being taken up within these teachings. And so the centers were being sustained by this. People abroad, like my mother, a few others also, they were being sustained through these Muralis. And gradually there was expansion and more acceptance of the teachings. And my next meeting with Brahma Baba was 1966, and by then I was 16, and it was very beautiful. Baba gave such love, and Baba had such wisdom, and Baba knew the future of each one. And at that time, when you're in that atmosphere, whether you understand or you don't, you flow with the waves. And so I was joining the morning class and hearing the Murali and not fully understanding it, because my comprehension in Hindi was minute and there was nobody who would translate really. But it was just a beautiful experience, and I felt I was in heaven. And when Baba saw me sitting there, Baba said, "She'll be a spiritual teacher." And I didn't understand at all what Baba meant. Either Baba was saying pleasant things just to give me a boost, you know, a grandfather will say nice things to a child. So I took it just in that spirit. But it was amazing to see how Baba's wisdom carried the whole community and created more and more centers. And by the time Baba left the physical dimension on the 18th of January 1969, it was 450 centers that had been established all over India. And by then, the Dadis had been given so much sustenance from Baba that Baba was confident that they'd be able to look after things. And I had surrendered in 1968. So that was a time when I recognized Brahma Baba as the instrument. I'd come in between before that also, but it was just again with that love rather than understanding. And when I said to Baba that I want to surrender, Baba said, "I knew it already." And I remembered that scene 3 years earlier when Baba had said it, but I didn't understand. But the meetings with Baba at that time, I met Baba 3 times that year. In June, when he gave me once about Drishti, the vision of soul consciousness and the exchange that happens. Have you experienced the magic of Drishti? How it's able to lift you beyond your own limitations into a different dimension. So I experienced Tapas Drishti in a very, very powerful way, and it changed my life. I came back again in October with a set of white clothes, so that Papa could send me wherever he wanted to send me. And Baba sent me with one of the seniors to go on a tour, and then she settled me in Agra, the place of the Taj Mahal. And that was a time of immense learning, and also many, many letters from Baba. And December, I came back again with a group of students and the other teachers. And again, it was a time that was very powerful. And we didn't know that it was Baba's final period. He knew. He knew much before. He probably knew in June. Because in the month of June, he said to Dadi Janki, she had been there, you've been to Pandav Bhavan, right? And you've seen where there's the Tower of Peace. Well, of course, there was no tower at that time. And it was just open space and garden on two sides and space. And so it was the badminton court. And in that space where there were trees, he said to Dadi Janki, I'm going to build a place there where you can come and stay, and all the teachers will come to you for training. Now that was June. And it actually materialized the next year in April, when Brahma Baba left. And you know about trance. You've heard about trance. Some sisters and brothers, a few brothers, it's like they're given a telescope. And that telescope enables them to see something far away in the subtle dimension. And they come back and tell us about it. And so it's being able to tune into another dimension and get a message and bring it to us. For Brahma Baba, when Shiv Baba came, it was really two souls sitting together, speaking. Mostly Shiv Baba speaking, but sometimes Brahma Baba speaking, sharing his experience. But what happened when Brahma Baba left, Dadi, the sister who was here at that time, Dadi Prakash Mani, she called Dadi Gulzar, one of Baba's trance messengers, to come. And then everything was being asked through the trance messenger. What should be done? What should be done? What should be done? So the first message was, don't hurry with the cremation. Normally, when somebody leaves in India, within the next few hours, the cremation is done. Many good reasons for that, physical and spiritual. But this time they were told, no, meditate. Just keep the body there in the history hall and meditate. There'll be many, many coming who will want to be there. And I arrived from Agra with the teachers from there on the morning of the 20th, 18th night Baba left, 19th, after hearing the news we travelled, 20th morning we arrived. And Baba's face was still, as if Baba was just resting, very beautiful. No discoloration, no nothing. The power of purity of the body was such that it was just a beautiful face. And we were told, carry on meditating. And then on the 21st, we were told, now it's time for the cremation. And by then, 700 people had arrived. And in that, normally we wouldn't be cooking whilst this is going on. And normally it's a few hours, but this time it was several days. But there was water and milk and tea, but everybody was free just to meditate. Nobody had to cook or clean or whatever. And so then you actually see the fire burning. And a very interesting thing, again, the messenger, the trance messenger had said, that the person who should light the fire should be the same lady who was there, Dadi Prakashmani. And she had been part of that group of eight, and she'd been 14 years old at that time. So now she was in her 40s. And at that moment, when Dadi was given the stick to light the fire, it was a very moving, very emotional moment. You start to pick blaze. But the other reason was that normally within such events, women don't usually go to attend funerals, cremations. And you never have a woman do the ceremony. You always have either the son, that would be the normal way, and if there isn't a son, a brother, or even your nephew, but it has to be male. But the instruction was very specific. It has to be Dadi Prakashmani. Brahma Baba's son, his biological son, was there. His spiritual son, Jatish Pai, who's the author of many of our books, he was there. But they were told Dadi Prakashmani has to light the fire. And so again, it was a very different thing that happened, not the normal Hindu system. And then after the fire is still burning, but things have really moved. The history hall where the body has been kept, everywhere was cleaned and the first food was cooked. And the food you get here, you know that it's first offered to God. In our homes, not just at the centers, but whatever we cook, we first offer to God, and then it's shared with everyone by mixing it into the big pot. It's the purification of food. It's the gratitude. It's the thanksgiving. It's all of that. So the first food was cooked and then was offered. And normally the trance messenger would go into trance and there'd be a message when she'd come back. This time, she went into trance and it was a long time. And then her eyes opened and like here was a table with a bhog offering. And the dadis were in front and the young sisters, including myself, just a handful of them were there. And they were very, very close. And when the eyes opened, for a moment it was a question, is it Dadi Gulzar or is it Baba? And through that drishti, you could feel it wasn't Dadi Gulzar, it was Baba. 700 people fitting into that small hall was impossible. They were standing in the corridors, they were standing at the back. But for half an hour, in that total silence, everybody got drishti. And then a voice began to speak, which wasn't Dadi Gulzar's normal voice. It was a masculine whisper. And we didn't have the equipment to be able to amplify the sound. Nobody knew this was going to happen. They tried rigging up the tape recorder and amplified, and it only reached as far as there, no further. But everybody sitting or standing was just silent. They knew they'd get it later, whatever, but they were just silent. And for that period of 3 hours, we were given guidance from the commander of the spiritual army, what was going to happen over the next period of time. And everything that was said has happened. A few things are still waiting to be seen. But mostly, I would say 90% of what was said has happened. So it was very powerful. One very moving moment was when Baba said, when a father goes, you don't find somebody else to take his place. When a guru goes, then there's a vacancy. You find the next one and they become the guru, but not when a father goes. What happens then? the elder brothers and sisters look after the younger ones. And so Bhavadan picked up a rose from the tray, the plate of flowers, a red rose, and put it on Didi Manmohini, who was the first woman to surrender in 1937. And the next rose was for Dadi Prakash Mani, who's I've been mentioning. And so Baba said, your elder sisters and the elder brothers will look after everyone. Then Baba looked around and said, does everyone agree? And everyone went like this. Then Baba said, does anyone have a question? There was no question. It was totally understood. So for 3 hours we were given all the information of what the next steps were going to be. And all of that has happened and things continue. And so we know that God's guiding hand is still with us. It wasn't just the work of this man, it was the work of God. And so there's a very interesting expression we use for the organization, especially in Mount Abu, or Abu I would say. We call it the yagya, the sacrificial fire. And the yagya is sacred. The yagya normally has priests who look after it, the Brahmins. And the yagya is the fire of purification. So Baba had given the name of the organization, not just Brahma Kumaris, etc., but the Rudra Yagya. Rudra is the name for Shiva, and you've heard about Shiva. So I had surrendered just in June, and January, Brahma Baba was gone. So the question in my mind was, what now? And this is immediately after hearing the news. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning, on the morning of the 19th. And so, as I sat in meditation, it came to me that my surrender was to God, Rudra Yagya, the sacrificial fire of God, not of this man. No wonder how wonderful this man is, was, now still in the angelic form. But so the story of my life is very connected with Brahma Baba. He gave me that spiritual birth. But after that also, I believe that the angel Brahma has been sustaining not just me, but all of us. Many people had visions of Brahma before they actually came to know who is Brahma. And when they'd see the photograph or the image, the painting, they'd say, yes, this is the one I saw in my vision or my dreams. It's a very difficult concept to connect with. A man becoming the chariot of God. It sounds a story. And it is a story, but it's a history, a real story. And my good fortune that I've been there at very significant moments of that story. So the cycle and the story of Brahma are very deeply connected, which is why we wanted to share the story of Brahma in the context of the cycle. Brahma, the first man who showed us how it was possible to become a deity, demonstrated it, walked the path he was talking about, and helped us move along that same path also. Let's close for a moment of silence and a short break, and we come back together. Om Shanti.